This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces by Radley Balko. This book is read by William Hughes. Chapter 7. The 1990s. It's all about the numbers. Why serve an arrest warrant to some crack dealer with a 38? With full armor, the right shit, and training, you can kick ass and have fun. U.S. military officer who conducted training seminars for civilian SWAT teams in the 1990s. The 1990s kicked off with a familiar debate. Congress wanted the military to be more involved with the drug war. At the urging of drug czar William Bennett, the Bush administration was waging aggressive anti-drug campaigns in Latin America, the most notable of which was the 1989 invasion of Panama to capture military governor Manuel Noriega, who was wanted in the United States for drug trafficking. That action was made possible by an opinion from the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. Issued a month before the invasion, the opinion concluded that the Posse Comitatus Act didn't apply outside of U.S. borders. Members of Congress followed by calling for more police-like actions by U.S. troops to arrest suspected drug dealers in other countries. Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney had led the Republican push for the 1988 drug bill that included the death penalty for drug dealers and widespread use of the military for drug interdiction. One Cheney lieutenant, Assistant Secretary of Defense Stephen Duncan, said at a 1991 conference, "We look forward to the day when our Congress allows the Army to lend its full strength toward making America drug-free." Even some career military officials were starting to come around, mostly out of fear that after the fall of communism in Europe, the military could suffer a loss of stature if it didn't find a new enemy to engage. "The Soviet threat is being taken away from us," one D.C. military scholar explained to the Chicago Tribune. "The Department of Defense had better develop some social utility arguments that match the requirements of the American people." Even Cheney drew the line at using active duty troops for civilian policing inside of U.S. borders, but that didn't seem to stop it from happening. The Christian Science Monitor reported in August 1990 that 58 active duty Army troops had assisted in Operation Clean Sweep, the latest marijuana eradication program in Northern California, and another 225 infantry soldiers and aviators and 9 UH-60 Black Hawk helicopters from Fort Lewis, Washington, helped find pot plants in Operation Ghost Dancer in Oregon. The early 1990s also saw a new push to find a greater drug war role for the National Guard. "When you have the equipment and trained personnel, you might as well put them to work," said Representative Nick Mavrules, a Massachusetts Democrat serving on the House Armed Services Committee. When asked about the traditional line separating the military from domestic policing, Republican Representative Duncan Hunter of California snapped, "It depends on which is more sacred, that line or your children's lives." One influential Capitol Hill staffer gave an especially confused justification. "We have to take some kind of action, not because it's going to solve the problem, but because of the fact that the druggies have gotten their fingers into an awful lot of pies." Part of the reason why so many politicians were enthusiastic was that National Guard involvement brought increased funding to their states. In 1989, the first year of the program, Congress appropriated $40 million for the National Guard's drug interdiction efforts. The next year, funding jumped to $70 million. 2 years later, it was up to $237 million. Any congressman or senator who opposed Guard troops fighting the drug war out of principle risked leaving his state out of the bounty. In Washington state, for example, the state's National Guard received just under $1 million for anti-drug operations. The next year, the state's congressional delegation signed a letter requesting 7 times that amount. In 1989, in Portland, Oregon, Herb Robinson of the Seattle Times noted, Fully armed guard troops had recently been stationed in front of suspected drug houses in a series of drug raids. In Kentucky, local residents became so enraged by frequent guard sweeps in low-flying helicopters that they blew up a radio tower used by the Kentucky State Police. In Oklahoma, guard troops dressed in battle garb rappelled down from helicopters and fanned out into rural areas in search of pot plants to uproot. National Guard units flew anti-drug surveillance helicopters and boarded up crack houses in Washington, D.C., flew surveillance helicopters and cruised the streets with infrared gear to spot drug houses in Brooklyn, sealed crack houses in Philadelphia, were sent to support drug raids in Baltimore, and helped serve 94 drug warrants during a massive citywide raid in Pittsburgh. Members of the Pennsylvania Guard assisted in raids of two factories that produced small glass vials. There were no drugs in the vials, but under state law, the vials were still illegal because they were primarily used by drug dealers to package crack cocaine. In the summer of 1990, an Army helicopter circled overhead as Massachusetts National Guard troops, some in uniform, some undercover, assisted police in Foxborough in identifying potential drug offenders at a Grateful Dead show. In rural Maine, the National Guard was assisting in Humboldt County-style raids in rural parts of the state. Guard helicopters would perform flyovers. Then raid teams consisting of federal and state officials would swoop in. The standard operating procedure is to come in with battering rams, weapons out and cocked, shouting profanities, a marijuana legalization activist in the town of Chesterville told the Associated Press in 1992. By the end of 1992, the National Guard's role in the drug war was fully operational. In that year alone, National Guard troops across the country assisted in nearly 20,000 arrests, searched 120,000 automobiles, entered 1,200 private buildings without a search warrant, and stepped onto private property to search for drugs, also without a warrant, 6,500 times. Colonel Richard Browning III, head of the organization's drug interdiction effort, declared that year, "The rapid growth of the drug scourge has shown that military force must be used to change the attitudes and activities of Americans who are dealing and using drugs. The National Guard is America's legally feasible attitude change agent." Symbolically, the National Guard bridges the gap between cop and soldier. Guard troops train like soldiers and dress like soldiers, and they are regularly called up to fight in wars overseas. But when they are acting under the authority of a state governor, Guard troops aren't subject to the restrictions of the Posse Comitatus Act. Giving the Guard a more prominent role in the drug war not only escalated the drug fight, it further conditioned the country to the idea of using forces that looked and acted quite a bit like soldiers for domestic law enforcement. With more and more funds flowing toward drug eradication, police agencies began to step on each other's toes to grab grants and shares of the money earmarked for various anti-drug programs. That produced tragic outcomes for any citizens caught in the middle. In January 1990, for example, President Bush initiated a new plan to crack down on drug smugglers at the border. He designated 5 border regions as high-intensity drug trafficking areas, making each region eligible for a cut of the $10.6 billion he had requested to fund the plan. One of the regions included the San Diego area. About 3 years into the program, 41-year-old Fortune 500 executive Donald Carlson awoke at around midnight to a pounding at his front door. He asked several times who was there. No one answered. Carlson became frightened. He walked back to his bedroom in the pitch dark to retrieve his gun, while nervously fumbling with a cordless phone as he attempted to call the police. Carlson then heard the glass window in his den shatter. That was followed by what he'd later describe as a thunderous explosion. Someone then yelled, "He's got a gun." Now terrified, Carlson fired at the door, hoping to scare the intruders away. Instead, they fired back. The first bullet flayed his upper thigh, severing his femoral artery. Carlson discarded the gun. He had just made it back to his bedroom when he dropped to the floor. He'd been hit by two more bullets. Carlson looked up and saw figures staring down at him, darkened behind the flashlights they were pointing in his face. One of them screamed at him, "Don't move, motherfucker, or I'll shoot." But the pain in Carlson's arm began to overcome his adrenaline, so he attempted to adjust it. Again, "Don't move, motherfucker, or I'll shoot." The men then rolled him over and handcuffed him. None of them attempted to give him medical attention. They left him to bleed in his own bedroom until paramedics arrived a half hour later. Carlson later said that, on the way to the hospital, he prayed for God to let him die. Fortunately, Carlson survived. What happened to him was a direct consequence of President Bush's new drug policy. The DEA and Customs had always had a bitter rivalry, going back to the Nixon years. Bush's 1990 border plan had shifted a great deal of the federal government's anti-drug strategy toward the border, putting Customs in charge. That angered the careerists at the DEA and only intensified the rivalry between the two agencies. Because they were competing for the same pot of money, pressure mounted for agents to make big busts, skim over constitutional protections, and play fast and loose with procedure. The Carlson shooting is an example of how competition between federal law enforcement works to the detriment of the public, one federal agent later told the San Diego Union-Tribune. A local judge agreed. There's no question that when you have turf wars between law enforcement agencies, you're going to have potential for disaster. The Carlson raid was part of Operation Alliance, which itself was part of a border interdiction effort in which Customs and the DEA were supposed to have been working together. Subsequent reports would show that the project only inflamed tensions. Customs officials were so eager to make a big bust that they had neglected to investigate the informant whose tip was their sole source of information for the raid. If they had done so, they'd have discovered that he had a history of lying. According to the Union Tribune, the DEA had been paying him $2,000 a month to work as an informant, but had dropped him 2 weeks prior to the Carlson raid because he was unreliable. According to one agent, when a DEA agent says this guy is no good, the first thing a customs agent wants to do is prove the DEA wrong. Odder still, because the two agencies were supposed to be working together, there were actually DEA agents who participated in the Carlson raid, which was based on a tip from the informant the DEA had just let go for being untrustworthy. The police found no drugs or any evidence of any criminal activity in Carlson's home. They had also raided another home on the same night, based on information from the same informant. That raid didn't turn up any contraband either. Nevertheless, Carlson spent the first several days of his convalescence shackled to his bed with an armed guard outside his room. By the time he testified before Congress the following June, he had been cleared of any wrongdoing. But the government still refused to give him the names of the agents who raided his home and who worked on the investigation. No one from the government had contacted him about taking care of his medical bills, which by then had topped $350,000, or covering the costs of repairing his house. No one had even bothered to apologize. And no agents had been disciplined or reprimanded, much less criminally charged. Only the informant had been charged, and those charges were later dismissed. Carlson and his attorney were told that neither Customs nor the DEA nor any of the local police agencies involved in the raid saw any reason to change their procedures as a result of what happened. In its report on the bureaucratic bumbling that led to the Carlson raid, the Union Tribune found evidence of other mistaken raids wrought by the same misplaced incentives. Mid-level managers and federal law enforcement agencies faced constant pressure to keep their statistics. Impressive seizures allowed these managers of the drug wars to ask for and receive larger staffs and higher pay. So long as performance was measured with raw seizure and arrest figures, drug agents told the paper, mistaken raids would remain a fact of life in drug work. Added a San Diego-era narcotics cop, every narc, at one time or another, has hit a wrong door. In December 1994, Carlson accepted a $2.75 million settlement from the federal government. He never got an apology. Proponents of no-knock raids and forced entry raids had always argued that scrutiny from judges and prosecutors would keep abuses and excesses in check. Yet the police officers interviewed for this book unanimously told me that, beginning in about the mid-1980s, judges almost never denied their requests for a search warrant. Some judges asked questions now and then, but even then they rarely denied a warrant. As the sheer volume of drug cases picked up in the late 1980s and into the 1990s, many judges stopped asking questions, too. A few officers said that they had known that some judges looked more closely at affidavits for no-knock warrants, but added that knock and announce requests were never a problem, even when everyone knew the warrant would be served with a dynamic entry. In 1992, University of Minnesota law professor Myron Orfield sent a questionnaire to Chicago judges, prosecutors, and defense attorneys to determine the state of the Fourth Amendment in that city. Even cynics would find the results dispiriting. More than one-fifth of Chicago judges believed that police lie in court more than half the time when questioned about searches and seizures. 92% of judges said that police lie at least some of the time, and 38% of judges said that they believed that police superiors encourage subordinates to lie in court. More than 50% of respondents believed that at least half of the time, the prosecutor knows or has reason to know that police fabricate evidence. Another 93% of respondents, including 89% of the prosecutors, reported that prosecutors have knowledge of perjury at least some of the time. 61% of respondents, including half of the surveyed prosecutors, believed that prosecutors know or have reason to know that police fabricate evidence in case reports, and half of prosecutors believed the same to be true when it comes to warrants. Prosecutors also described the unspoken understandings they often shared with cops, including prosecutors articulating cases to police in terms like, "If this happens, we win. If that happens, we lose." Yet, Chicago judges went on approving search warrants with little to no scrutiny. Orfield asked one more question. Did the exclusionary rule really deter police misconduct? Every judge, every defense attorney, and every prosecutor but one answered yes. Former narcotics cop Russ Jones says it wasn't always like that. When I first started writing search warrants, I had to take it to the DA, who would thoroughly review it. Then I'd take it to the judge, who'd also give it a close look. Then the judge always read the warrant, always asked questions. By the time I left law enforcement, and certainly since, it had gotten to the point where the DEA no longer needed to have warrants reviewed by a federal prosecutor, and often the judge wouldn't even read it. It just became a rubber stamp process, and I understand it's happening more and more. In many jurisdictions, search warrants can be approved by magistrates who needn't even have any legal training. The 1984 study of the warrant process in 7 U.S. cities by the National Center for State Courts found that magistrates spend an average of 2 minutes and 48 seconds reviewing warrant affidavits before, almost always, approving the warrant. The study also found evidence that police magistrate shop. They seek out magistrates with a reputation for approving warrants quickly and with no hassles, and avoid those who ask questions. In one city, a single magistrate approved 54% of the search warrants over the period the study was conducted. The most popular magistrate in another city had rejected just one search warrant in 15 years on the bench. Not surprisingly, most police officers interviewed could not remember having a search warrant turned down. After the botched raid that ended the life of Ishmael Mena in 1999, the Denver Post looked into how judges in the Mile High City handled requests for no-knock warrants. Again, the results were unsettling. Over a 12-month period, police in Denver requested 163 no-knock warrants. The city's judges granted 158 of them. Defense attorneys told the paper they were surprised to learn that the judges had rejected even 5. Perhaps Denver police had come to the judges with more than adequate probable cause. Perhaps. But the paper also found that, astonishingly, many of the city's judges would sign off on no-knock warrants even though the police hadn't requested one. In fact, about 10% of the no-knock warrants were changed from knock-and-announce warrants merely by the judge's signature. The police hadn't presented any additional information establishing exigent circumstances. The paper also found that in 8 of 10 raids over that period, police assertions in affidavits that they would find weapons during the search turned out to be wrong. In only 7 of the 163 no-knock affidavits did police present any evidence that the suspect had been seen with a gun. Of those 7 raids, just 2 turned up an actual weapon. The Denver Police Department requires that all no-knock raids be pre-approved by the DA's office. In about 1/3 of the raids, that never happened. And nearly all the no-knock warrants were granted on little more than a police officer's assertion that a confidential informant had told him the suspect was armed or likely to dispose of drug evidence, with no additional corroborating information. When confronted with the results of the investigation, the presiding judge over Denver's criminal court system wasn't particularly reassuring. "We are not fact-gatherers," Judge Robert Patterson said. "It's pretty formulaic how it's done." On how a judge could possibly inadvertently approve a no-knock warrant when the police hadn't even asked for one, Patterson said, "If you sign your name 100 times, you can look away and sign in the wrong place. We read a lot of documents. We may, just like anyone else, sign something and realize later that it's the wrong place or the wrong thing. Is it wrong not to be paying attention? No. It's just that we're doing things over and over again." Hearing Patterson's explanation, you'd think he was talking about the elementary school teacher who might occasionally misgrade one of dozens of homework assignments. This was about giving armed law enforcement officers permission to break into homes in the middle of the night, detonate flashbang grenades, and point their guns at Denver citizens. Patterson, astonishingly, was calmly explaining how the city's judges couldn't even be bothered to pay attention to where they signed their names. Judges and prosecutors weren't just neglecting their responsibility to protect the Fourth Amendment. They were nearly conspiring against it. The early 1990s weren't kind to the father of SWAT. In response to the Rodney King beating of May 1991, Los Angeles Mayor Tom Bradley asked Warren Christopher to chair a commission looking into the LAPD's use of excessive force. The commission's report was damning. It found that a small but significant group of police officers within the department regularly used excessive force, and that LAPD leadership did little to stop them. Between 1986 and 1990, the city had faced 83 lawsuits that resulted in settlements of awards of over $15,000. The commission found that even though officer misconduct in those cases had often been egregious, it had usually resulted in light and often non-existent discipline. The commission reviewed radio transmissions of LAPD officers referring to a drug roundup in a black neighborhood as "monkey slapping time," or fantasizing about driving down one particular street with a flamethrower. "We would have a barbecue." The comments themselves would have been bad enough. Even worse was the fact that a culture existed within the department in which officers felt free to make them over police radio. The LAPD's focus on reacting to crime instead of preventing it, the commission found, had isolated officers from the communities they patrolled. Cops were rewarded for putting up impressive arrest statistics and for being hard-nosed. The report found that drug and gang sweeps of the late 1980s had alienated LAPD cops from the community, creating reciprocal hostility and resentment. The LAPD did a poor job of screening applicants for violent backgrounds, and the department's training put far too much emphasis on force and too little on communication and problem-solving. The commission found that when Academy students went out in the field, they were quickly schooled to view the world from a we-they perspective. It also found that many of the field training officers who gave new cops their first experiences on the street themselves had histories of misconduct or excessive use of force. The commission's finding on how the LAPD handled citizen complaints was perhaps the most disturbing and enlightening part of the Christopher Report. Of the 2,152 complaints filed against LAPD cops between 1986 and 1990, just 42 had been found credible by the department. Most were handled by the accused officers' supervisors, not by internal affairs. Intake officers actively discouraged citizens who tried to file complaints, often with verbal harassment or by making them wait for long periods of time. Investigating officers made no attempt to find independent witnesses, meaning that the investigations often came down to the officer's word against the complainants. After shootings, officers were usually granted an unrecorded pre-interview before they were questioned on tape. The officers involved were also usually interviewed as a group, not individually, all of which gave them opportunity to work out any inconsistencies or contradictions in the story. Perhaps most tellingly, the commission found that when officers were disciplined, the punishment given to officers who had embarrassed the department, drug use, corruption, theft, was much more severe than the punishment given to officers who used excessive force or violated a citizen's constitutional rights, again reflecting a culture of us versus them. The Christopher Commission made a number of recommendations, but one made much more of a splash than the others. It recommended that Daryl Gates be removed as chief of police. Gates announced his intent to resign on July 13, 1991, 3 days after the Christopher Report came out. But by the time the L.A. riots broke out the following April, Gates was still in office. Sparked by a jury's decision to acquit the LAPD officers who beat Rodney King, the riots themselves lasted 4 days, although there were flare-ups of violence in the days that followed. In all, 13,500 troops from the California National Guard, the 3rd Battalion 1st Marine, and the 40th Infantry Division and 7th Infantry Division of the U.S. Army were sent in to stop the violence. There were 53 fatalities, over 2,000 injured, and property damage of more than $1 billion. The Watts riots in 1965 had made Daryl Gates a rising star within the LAPD. The helplessness that Gates and his officers felt while getting shot at by snipers in what had become an urban war zone had inspired him to create and push for the SWAT team, his most influential and lasting legacy. 27 years later, the riots after the Rodney King verdict effectively ended Gates's career. By then, SWAT teams across America numbered in the thousands. Most of them weren't responding to riots or Black Panther barricades or shootings like the one on Surrey Street. Most SWAT teams were spending most of their time breaking down doors on drug raids. Though rioting gave birth to Gates's legacy in 1965, his proudest legacy was powerless to stop the rioting in 1992. Order wasn't restored until the National Guard showed up. One other big difference between Watts and the 1992 riots. Far more Americans were beginning to see problems with police brutality. When Gallup asked, "Do you think there is police brutality in your area?" in 1967, just 6% said yes. In July 1991, it was 39%. On June 28, 1992, Gates resigned from the Los Angeles Police Department, this time for real. As noted previously, after implementing many of the community policing practices proposed by Norm Stamper, San Diego was seeing some progress. Crime had started to go down in the city, even as it continued to rise elsewhere in the country, and police-community relations were improving. By 1992, Stamper was Burgreen's right-hand man. Burgreen asked Stamper to conduct an audit of the entire department, instructing his top deputy to concentrate on our warts. After conducting his audit, Stamper made a number of proposals, but one of them was particularly interesting. He wanted to demilitarize the department. Stapper knew of a few smaller police departments that had tried demilitarizing to various degrees with mixed results. Back in 1970, the town of Lakewood, Colorado, built a new department from the ground up. Police Chief Pierce Brooks wanted a department that looked more like it was part of the community than an outside force charged with keeping the community in line. So the cops wore slacks and blazers instead of military-like uniforms. Instead of using army ranks like sergeant or lieutenant, they took titles like field advisor. Rank-and-file cops were called agents. The Lakewood experiment was short-lived. By 1973, they were back to using traditional titles and the conventional police blues. Similar efforts in Menlo Park and Beverly Hills, California, hadn't gone quite as far, but had been somewhat more successful. Stamper's proposal was relatively mild by comparison. As he writes in his book, Breaking Rank, I knew there'd be a shit rain of opposition. Military titles are a cultural icon in civilian policing, as much a part of the cop culture as mustaches, sidearms, and donuts. But win or lose, I thought it was important to air the rationale behind demilitarization. I hoped to encourage a department-wide dialogue on the principles of a more democratic, less militaristic police force. And since language structures reality, I was convinced that our military nomenclature stood between us and the community. Stamper's idea was to change the titles of sergeant, lieutenant, and captain to titles less evocative of the military. He suggested looking to federal law enforcement. The FBI, for instance, had agents, special agents, and supervisors. Burgreen was dubious, not because he necessarily disagreed, but because he knew the idea would be dead on arrival within the department. He gave Stamper 2 months to try it out. Burgreen was right. The department erupted in protests. Letters to the editor of the department's internal newsletter howled with derision. The San Diego Union-Tribune got wind of the idea and spat on it in an editorial. Stamper had a few supporters, but only a few. One of them, oddly enough, was former Reagan Attorney General Ed Meese. Stamper writes in his book about one lieutenant who initially scoffed at the proposal but later came around. The more I thought about it, the more I realized we're not the military. We're cops. We're community cops. We ought to have titles that make sense to the community. What does lieutenant or sergeant mean to the average citizen? A related question. What effect do such titles have on the average cop? Still, as Stamper writes, of the department's 2,800 employees, the lieutenant's change of heart brought the number of converts up to approximately 11. Stamper's proposal didn't involve demilitarizing police tactics. He wasn't suggesting that they disband the SWAT teams, or get rid of their guns, or even switch to slacks and blazers. All he was proposing was that they ditch the military titles and jargon. And there was no way it was ever going to happen. But Stamper wasn't the only high-ranking law enforcement official growing concerned about militarization in the 1990s. In a 1993 article for the FBI's Law Enforcement Bulletin, Lieutenant Tom Gabor of the Culver City, California Police Department argued that SWAT teams were becoming too ubiquitous and being used in ways that were inappropriate for police work. Gabor wrote that the massive rise in deployments of SWAT teams across the country was more about justifying the costs of maintaining the units than about maintaining public safety. Even as early as 1993, Gabor had already noticed that in many organizations, patrol leaders feel pressured to call for SWAT assistance on borderline cases, even though field supervisors believe that patrol personnel could resolve the incident. In Wisconsin, Marquette County Sheriff Rick Fulmer actually disbanded his department's SWAT team in 1996. Quite frankly, they get excited about dressing up in black and doing that kind of thing. Fulmer told the Madison Capital Times, I said, this is ridiculous. All we're going to end up doing is getting people hurt. In New Haven, Connecticut, Police Chief Nick Pastore was facing growing pressure to collect military gear from the Pentagon and to use his SWAT team in situations where he thought it was inappropriate. Pastore told the New York Times that outfitting cops in battle garb feeds a mindset that you're not a police officer serving the community, you're a soldier at war. I had some tough guy cops in my department pushing for bigger and more hardware. They used to say, "It's a war out there." They like SWAT because it's an adventure. Pastore also worried about the martial rhetoric. If you think everyone who uses drugs is the enemy, then you're more likely to declare war on the people. In another interview with The Nation, Pastore pointed out that before he took over, New Haven's SWAT team was being called out several times a week. The whole city was suffering trauma, he said. We had politicians saying, "The streets are a war zone. The police have taken over." And the police were driven by fear and adventure. SWAT was a big part of that. After Pastore took over, New Haven's SWAT team was called out just 4 times in all of 1998. Lo and behold, reserving the SWAT team for true emergencies didn't lead to a criminal takeover of New Haven. In fact, the city's crime rate dropped at a brisker pace than that of the rest of Connecticut, which also dropped, from 13,950 incidents in 1997 to 9,455 in 2000. In Colorado, the Denver Post ran an article in 1995 about 3 area deaths from no-knock drug raids in the area in 33 months, including a 16-year-old boy, a deputy sheriff, and a 54-year-old grandfather of 8. "Such raids are very dangerous," said Pitkin County Sheriff Robert Broadus. "They are the closest thing I can think of to a military action in a democratic society." Broadus explained that it was far safer to conduct surveillance, to learn a suspect's routine, and to then do a quick, quiet arrest when a suspect is in the open. As for possible destruction of evidence, he said that his department would have the waters shut off before serving a warrant, by knocking at the door and waiting for an answer. In some cases, they had arranged for a plumber to set up a catch net to capture anything flushed after police arrived to serve the warrant. But Broadus said that his concern went beyond the SWAT tactics. "The war on drugs is an abysmal failure," he said. "Even the term creates a dangerous war mentality." In 1998, the city of Albuquerque, New Mexico, commissioned an outside investigation after a series of questionable shootings and SWAT incidents. In one case that made national news, a SWAT officer said to his colleagues, "Let's go get the bad guy," just before the team went to confront 33-year-old Larry Walker. The bad guy wasn't a terrorist, a killer, or even a drug dealer, but a depressed man whose family had called the police because they feared he might be contemplating suicide. The SWAT team showed up in full battle attire, including assault rifles and flashbang grenades. They found Walker cowering under a juniper tree, the New York Times later reported, then shot him dead from 43 feet away. The city brought in Sam Walker, a well-regarded criminologist at the University of Nebraska, to evaluate the police department's use of lethal force. Walker was astonished by what he found. "The rate of police killings was just off the charts," Walker told the Times. The city's SWAT team, he said, had an organizational structure that led them to escalate situations upward rather than de-escalating. The city then brought in Toledo, Ohio Police Chief Jerry Galvin to take over its police department. Galvin immediately disbanded the SWAT team, toned down the militarism, and implemented community policing policies. He told the Times, "If cops have a mindset that the goal is to take out a citizen, it will happen." The election of Bill Clinton in 1992 gave hope to some in the drug reform community that an admitted pot smoker who had some ties to the counterculture during his college days might bring a less aggressive and less militaristic approach to federal drug policy. Those hopes were dashed pretty quickly. Clinton and his appointees weren't as bellicose as Reagan and Bush or Meese and Bennett, but the policies that Clinton implemented showed little understanding or appreciation of the symbolic Third Amendment. In 1993, for example, the Justice Department and the Defense Department entered into a formalized technology and equipment sharing agreement. Not only were American police forces becoming more militarized, the thinking went, but in places like Korea, the U.S. military was taking on more of a policing role. It only made sense for the two institutions to work more closely together. Attorney General Janet Reno explained this strategy in a speech to defense and intelligence specialists. "So let me welcome you to the kind of war our police fight every day," Reno said. "And let me challenge you to turn your skills that served us so well in the Cold War to helping us with the war we're now fighting daily in the streets of our towns and cities across the nation." In 1997, the resulting Department of Justice and Department of Defense Joint Technology Program released a report on the new agency's anniversary. Many of the projects the program developed seemed relatively innocuous, such as using police and military experience to develop better body armor, or developing technology to locate snipers, which could be a benefit to both institutions. But the report also includes some more troubling projects, such as developing less lethal, faster-acting pyrotechnic devices, such as flashbang grenades, and a gas-launched, wireless, electric stun projectile with a self-contained power supply that adheres to clothing and imparts a strong electric shock. The report discusses developing sound cannons for use in crowd control, and a project to develop miniature, low-cost, wireless, modular devices that can locate, identify, and monitor the movement of selected individuals. Most concerning, however, is the language in which the report describes the relationship between the police and the military. While acknowledging at the outset that the two institutions have very different roles, the report asserts that those distinctions are eroding, particularly with respect to the war on drugs and the war on terrorism. In one particularly troubling passage, the report cautions that both institutions need to be less transparent about the use of force. Another factor in how the military and law enforcement apply force, the report notes, is the greater presence of members of the media who are observing, if not recording, situations in which force is applied. Even the lawful application of force can be misrepresented to or misunderstood by the public. More than ever, the report concludes, the police and the military need to be highly discreet to keep applications of force out of the public eye. There were other indications that Clinton didn't appreciate the distinction between the military and civilian policing. He nominated Barry McCaffrey, an actual retired general, to be his drug czar. There was also his Troops to Cops program, which subsidized police departments for hiring returning veterans. While there is nothing inherently wrong with allowing veterans to apply to become police officers, providing a federal grant enabling them to do so risked incentivizing police departments to give a pass to vets hardened or traumatized by war who might be psychologically unfit for the job. But more broadly, the program demonstrated a belief that the two jobs are similar, that because both troops and cops carry guns, wear uniforms, and are authorized to use force, anyone trained as a soldier naturally makes a good cop. This is certainly possible, but there's little about military service that would make a soldier a better candidate to become a police officer than other applicants, at least as the job of police officer is properly understood. And there's a good argument to be made that soldiers who have seen combat ought to get extra scrutiny before they're given a badge and a gun. Clinton was also responsible for one policy in particular that not only encouraged paramilitary raids on low-level offenders, even users, but by its very nature also directed such raids only at the poor. In March 1996, an ABC News crew went along on a no-knock SWAT raid in Toledo, Ohio. The 14-member squad performed a dynamic entry into the house, threw its occupants to the ground at gunpoint, then tore the place apart in a drug search. They found less than an ounce of pot in the bedroom of a teenager who lived in the house with his family. You might think that ABC News broadcast the raid to show an abuse of police power, that the raiding SWAT team felt embarrassed about using such force for such a petty crime. But in fact, the raid was broadcast because it was considered a successful enforcement of a new federal policy. The home the police had raided was public housing, Under the Clinton administration's new one-strike-and-you're-out policy, any drug offense, even a misdemeanor, committed in public housing supported by federal funding was grounds for eviction. The policy applied even if the drug offense was committed by someone who didn't live in the home or was committed without the tenant's knowledge. It was a popular idea. After all, why should taxpayers subsidize the drug habits of people on public assistance? Of course, there was no similar policy for recipients of corporate welfare or for elected officials who received government paychecks. No matter. The ABC News report characterized the raid as a small victory in the war on drugs. Prior to 1995, the U.S. Supreme Court had always considered cases involving the knock-and-announce rule, and there hadn't been very many of them, either under the rule's common law tradition or under the section of the U.S. Criminal Code describing the conditions under which a federal agent is permitted to force his way into a private residence. Though the knock-and-announce requirement is included in that law, the court had yet to state that the rule, and thus the Castle Doctrine, was included in the protections against unreasonable search and seizure afforded by the Fourth Amendment. Justice Brennan had argued for that position in Kerr v. California, but fell one vote short of getting a majority. In the 1995 case Wilson v. Arkansas, the court unanimously ruled that the rule is part of the tapestry of the Fourth Amendment. Justice Clarence Thomas relayed the long common law history of the rule, as well as the events prior to the American Revolution that gave rise to the Fourth Amendment. But Thomas also noted the common law exceptions to the rule, exceptions that, as Brennan pointed out in Kerr, didn't really exist prior to 1962, but that U.S. courts, Congress, and state legislatures had since recognized anyway. Thomas cautioned that the court's ruling should not be read to mandate a rigid rule of announcement that ignores countervailing law enforcement interests. Here he was referring to the two most widely recognized exigent circumstances that allow police to ignore the knock-and-announce rule: destruction of evidence and the threat of harm to police officers. After waxing historic on the long and storied tradition of the Castle Doctrine and the knock-and-announce rule, Thomas had finally ruled, with unanimous agreement from his colleagues, that the rule is part and parcel of the Fourth Amendment, but then took note of the exceptions to the rule that would allow police to all but ignore it. Thomas didn't get into specifics about the conditions that would qualify as exigent circumstances, but in a series of cases over the next 10 years, the court would begin to hash them out. The next case to address the issue was Richards v. Wisconsin in 1997. After Wilson, several states gave police permission to conduct no-knock raids in any narcotics investigation, on the theory that drugs were easy to destroy in a hurry, generally by flushing them down the toilet. In Richards, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled just that. Narcotics cases, by their very nature, merit a blanket exception to the knock-and-announce rule, on the theory that all drugs can be easily and quickly disposed. The Supreme Court overruled, but the opinion by Justice John Paul Stevens was narrowly written. Stevens came up with a couple of examples of cases where the destruction of evidence rule wouldn't apply, such as a search conducted at a time when the only individuals present in a residence have no connection with the drug activity and will thus be unlikely to threaten officers or destroy evidence, or when police could know that the drugs being searched for were of a type or in a location that made them impossible to destroy quickly. The first scenario seems unlikely. Police usually say that they need to serve warrants when the suspect is home in order to tie him to the drugs. It also makes it easier to make an arrest. Ironically, the second scenario gives more protection to major drug dealers than to small-time dealers or people who possess drugs for personal use. Cases involving drugs of a type unlikely to be quickly disposable would be cases involving large quantities of drugs, and drugs in a location that makes them impossible to destroy quickly would probably be drugs that aren't in a building with a toilet or sink nearby. As a result, Stevens's opinion offered more protection for people suspected of storing drugs in warehouses or businesses than for people suspected of storing them in their homes. The court rejected a blanket narcotics exception to knock and announce, but Stevens' opinion seemed to indicate that only a small selection of drug cases could fall outside the exception. The court actually upheld the conviction against Richards. The court also put some limits on judicial oversight over forced entry raids, ruling that a magistrate's decision not to authorize a no-knock entry should not be interpreted to remove the officer's authority to exercise independent judgment concerning the wisdom of a no-knock entry at the time the warrant is being executed. So even when denied a no-knock warrant, police could go ahead and decide at the scene to do a no-knock raid anyway. The court also ruled that police only need to have reasonable suspicion that one of the three exigent circumstances exists in order to dispense with the announcement requirement, and that the standard of evidence for that reasonable suspicion is not high. Like Wilson, Richards appeared to be another victory for the Castle Doctrine that also threatened to ruin it. After Richards, state courts fell back on the particularity approach to determine when a no-knock raid was or wasn't merited. Judges determined whether a suspect was likely to destroy evidence on a case-by-case basis. There was no reliable, predictable standard. As we've seen, in the absence of such guidelines, and as judges were increasingly swamped with drug cases and drug warrants, the default position tended to defer to the judgment of police, even when the language in search warrant affidavits began to look like boilerplate. It's worth noting here that on the rare occasions when warrants are challenged, the challenges necessarily occur, of course, after the warrant has been served. It would be ludicrous to notify a suspect of a surprise search warrant ahead of time so that he could challenge its legitimacy in court. But it's also worth remembering that these warrants give police permission to mete out extraordinary violence on people still only suspected of nonviolent crimes. When police get the right house with a questionable warrant, at worst, the evidence they collect will be ruled inadmissible. In cases where questionable warrants lead to wrong-door raids, mistaken shootings, or some other calamitous outcome, the suspect's opportunity to challenge the warrant comes only after the harm has been done. That augurs for a system in which judges play an enormously important role in ensuring the validity and soundness of warrants, as well as for a clear set of guidelines and high evidentiary standards under which they would make those decisions. Instead, the Supreme Court has consistently ruled that judges should err on the side of putting their faith in the police. In the 1999 case United States v. Ramirez, the court did what it stopped short of doing in Wilson. It formally ruled that the destruction of evidence exception, the threat to a police officer exception, and the useless gesture exception all permitted police to break into a home without first knocking and announcing. The court also ruled that those exceptions apply to the section of the U.S. Criminal Code on forced entry for federal officers, even though the law itself makes no mention of such exceptions. This was a curious undertaking by the court's conservatives. They were adding exceptions to a law that it seems likely would have been included in the original language, had its authors and the Congress at the time actually intended the exceptions to be included. And the court was doing so by putting more value on the common law than on the plain language of the statute. And even this was based on a flawed understanding of the common law. The court's conservative wing has always believed in original intent, except when it hasn't. By the end of the 1990s, the court seemed to have all but sunk the Castle Doctrine. Yet in the following decade, the justices would find yet more ways to give police yet more discretion to bring more violence into Americans' living rooms and bedrooms. Now, if the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms comes to disarm you, and they are bearing arms, resist them with arms. Go for a headshot. They're going to be wearing bulletproof vests. They've got a big target on there, ATF. Don't shoot at that, because they've got a vest on underneath that. Headshots. Headshots. Kill the sons of bitches. That was G. Gordon Liddy, giving his listeners home defense advice on his syndicated radio show in August 1994. It was some remarkable language to be coming from the guy who helped create ODALE, the Nixon-era office that sent narcotics task forces barreling into homes to make headline-grabbing drug busts. And Liddy was still suffering from cognitive dissonance. In the same interview, he lamented that it wasn't a federal felony to possess a personal use amount of illicit drugs. And of course, narcotics cops hit the wrong house many, many more times than ATF agents did. Liddy wasn't offended by the tactics as much as he was by the mission, gun control, and the people who were calling the shots at the time, Bill Clinton and Janet Reno. Still, this was part of something new. Outside of Liddy, other figures on the right were also starting to speak out against the lurch toward militarism among federal law enforcement agencies. A few high-profile incidents seemed to instigate the concern on the right, including the gunfights in Ruby Ridge, Idaho, in 1992, the raid on the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, in 1993, and the raid to seize Cuban refugee Elian Gonzalez from his Miami relatives in 2000. The Ruby Ridge fiasco began in 1989, when Randy Weaver sold an ATF informant two sawed-off shotguns that had been cut shorter than was allowed under federal law. Weaver was no doubt an odd duck. He and his wife Vicky had moved their family to rural Idaho in 1983 to escape what they believed to be the coming Armageddon. He associated with white supremacists and, in fact, met the ATF informant at a meeting of the Aryan Nations. The informant's handler at the ATF didn't think Weaver was much of a threat, so rather than charge Weaver, the ATF attempted to leverage the gun charges to get him to work as an informant. When Weaver refused, the agent filed federal gun charges. On August 21, 1992, a team of U.S. Marshals dressed in camouflage and carrying M-16s went to Weaver's home on a reconnaissance mission to determine an appropriate place and manner to capture him. Once there, one of the marshals threw rocks at the Weaver cabin to see how the family's dogs would react. The dogs went nuts. Hearing them, Weaver's 14-year-old son Sammy went out with family friend Kevin Harris to see what the commotion was about. Accounts of the incident differ here, but at some point, one of the agents shot and killed one of the Weaver's dogs. Sammy Weaver responded by firing his own gun at the source of the gunfire, then fled toward the house. One of the marshals then shot him in the back as he ran. Sammy Weaver was dead. Harris then exchanged fire with the marshals, killing one of them. A 12-day siege ensued, featuring hundreds of cops, agents, and troops from the ATF, the FBI, the U.S. Marshals, the Idaho State Police, the local Sheriff's Department, the Idaho National Guard, and, for some reason, the U.S. Border Patrol. On day two of the siege, FBI sniper teams were told that their rules of engagement were, basically, to shoot on sight, instructions usually reserved for the battlefield and virtually unheard of in civil law enforcement. When Randy Weaver left the house to visit the body of his son, which they had put in a guest cabin, an FBI sniper shot him in the chest. As Weaver, Harris, and one of Weaver's daughters fled back into the house, the agent fired again at the front door. That bullet went through the door, then through Vicky Weaver's head, killing her instantly. She was holding her 10-month-old daughter at the time. The baby fell to the floor. Weaver and Harris were eventually tried in federal court for murder, attempted murder, and other felonies. They were acquitted on all of the serious charges. The federal government eventually settled with the Weaver family for over $3 million and with Weaver for $380,000. The raid in Waco the next year involved many of the same agencies, indeed many of the same agents. The ATF was investigating the Branch Davidians and their leader, David Koresh, for weapons violations. Koresh went jogging every day and could conceivably have been picked up peacefully. Instead, the agency drew up plans for a heavily armed raid on the Branch Davidian compound, even knowing that there were women and children inside. In fact, ATF officials learned ahead of time from an agent who had infiltrated the compound that Koresh and his followers knew the raid was coming. Their plan depended on the element of surprise. They went through with it anyway. The raid began on February 28, 1993, as cattle trailers of federal agents pulled up to the compound. The raid planners hadn't bothered to instruct any individual agent to announce their presence or purpose, nor had they made any plans for even the possibility of serving their warrants peacefully. The initial confrontation ended with 2 hours of gunfire, 4 dead federal agents, and 6 dead Branch Davidians, but no resolution. Both sides claimed the other started shooting first. The subsequent siege went on for 6 weeks. Finally, on April 19th, Attorney General Janet Reno gave orders to flush the Branch Davidians out of the compound. Federal agents used tanks to smash holes in the building, into which they then injected tear gas canisters. They next used grenade launchers to shoot 350 ferret rounds of gas through windows and doors. A fire broke out, which eventually consumed the building and nearly everyone inside. In all, 76 Davidians died, including 26 children. Waco and Ruby Ridge made militarization a political issue. Perhaps counterintuitively, the laws the agents were enforcing, federal gun control laws, put conservatives in the unprecedented role of criticizing federal cops for overkill, and liberals in the position of defending the aggressive tactics. One fact about Waco that conservative ATF critics often overlook: the military presence at the compound was only made possible by the drug war. The ATF told the leaders of Joint Task Force 6, one of the many military-civilian police anti-drug task forces set up during the Reagan and Bush administrations, that David Koresh was running a methamphetamine operation. The evidence for this was suspect at best. As for the ATF itself, the agency appeared to be suffering from the same afflictions that a decade of warring on drugs and crime had brought out in other federal police agencies. Back in 1991, for example, 60 agents from the ATF, the DEA, the U.S. Forest Service, and the National Guard, the latter wearing face paint and camouflage, raided 3 homes in New Mexico based on an unsubstantiated tip from a confidential informant that they would find drugs and weapons. The ATF led the investigation because of federal laws prohibiting the use of guns by drug offenders. They found nothing. Later the same year, 60 ATF agents invited television crews to film them while they raided the Oklahoma home of John Lawmaster. They had received a tip that Lawmaster had illegally converted one of his semi-automatic weapons to an automatic. They ripped Lawmaster's home to shreds, but found no evidence that he'd broken any law. Lawmaster wasn't home at the time. When he returned, he found his door